Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, joined with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show, and a big shout out to Shad throughout the middle to tail end of the week as I was away. Shad took over all the daily editorials and had some great commentary, so make sure you go back and listen to a lot of those daily editorials and even some of those focused on some stocks that our commentators like. We're going to get right into this show because we are kicking off the show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group, also editor of the Book Report website. I will post a link within the weekend show posting to Peter's website, that Book Report, and that's where he breaks down all recent data and any key market moves that have his attention. Now, Peter, I read over every email that you send out through the Book Report, and I really want to start focused here on inflation. Look, you've been watching the data closely. You've had a very level-headed approach to just where inflation's going, and everybody has been throwing around that whole, is it transitory? Is inflation not transitory? We've seen a little pullback in some of those high inflation numbers that we had from months ago. Peter, break down what you think is important to understand about inflation and where you think it's going, please.
Well, services inflation, which is about 60% of core CPI, headline CPI, which is services inflation ex energy, that's never transitory. In the 20 years leading into COVID, that averaged 2.8% per annum of an increase. So the real debate is where does the good side of that inflation equation go to? And we are no question seeing a cyclical upturn in inflation on the good side. That's obviously filtered into the services side as well. And I'm not of the opinion that it just gets fixed so quickly, because it is so widespread, and because in particular transportation costs have gone up so much, and there's some secular factors that could keep transportation costs elevated. And the reason why I throw in that is because we know every single good that is produced in this world ends up on a truck, a ship, a plane, or a railroad. So if those prices stay elevated, that also embeds itself into the good side. So at some point things will be somewhat more normalized, but all you need is a couple of years of sticky inflation, persistent inflation of 3-4%, and that creates its own problems. It hurts growth as real wages fall. A world of negative interest rates, zero interest rates, and all this QE is certainly not a good backdrop for persistent inflation. And it also hamstrings or handcuffs, I should say, the central bank's ability to continue on as they have been continuing on, in the sense that when inflation is low, you know, they feel they have license to do whatever they want at the pace they want. But if inflation becomes more of a problem, more of a challenge here, then that license may actually get taken away, and the market then possibly forces things upon the Fed.
Well, Peter, one of the things that we all know is that the government metrics don't really factor in all of the different areas of inflation. Some of the energy components, some of the way they calculate renters, and some of just the other areas, food, is not in there. But anybody that goes to a grocery store, anybody that goes out and buys something, can see inflation in their daily lives. But there's going to be a point where if inflation is sticky, and if it does stick around, that beyond the taper talks, they may have to start looking at tightening. But we all know if the Fed starts to tighten in this environment, they have such a huge balance sheet that it would be problematic. So how do you see that all squaring off?
Well, I think ending QE is going to be enough of a challenge for them. When I say challenge, it's obviously easy to do. You just pick a day when you're starting and you space it out. But difficult for them, because I don't know if they're going to have the guts to follow through with it. Because if the stock market, or I should say when the stock market falls in response to tapering, and I say when, not if, it's because every single correction of note outside of the Chinese yuan devaluation in 2015, and COVID coincided around the end of QE or tapering of QE in addition to rate hikes, do they have the intestinal fortitude and the guts to continue on in the face of a fall in the stock market? So I don't think that they're going to be thinking about raising rates until QE is done. I think one of the lessons they learned in 2017, 2018 was not to shrink your... Now, obviously ending QE is different than quantitative tightening where the balance sheet actually shrinks. The first thing the Fed's going to do is obviously maintain the level of their balance sheet when QE is over. And of course, that level is going to be much higher than the size of their balance sheet. But I think they are really focused on getting that done first before we talk about raising interest rates. But that also gets to the point of them being so far behind the curve here, is that here we have pretty aggressive inflation stats, which I think will continue, not necessarily at the same pace that we've seen, but at a much higher than a level than people are used to, that even when they're done with QE, rates are still going to be at zero. And yes, that will be at some point something that they're going to have to face. And like I said earlier, the direction of inflation will sort of assert that timeline for them rather than them doing it themselves. So to that point, the Fed may keep rates at zero as they end QE, but if the bond market is worried about inflation still, they'll tighten for them, which is essentially what we had in the first quarter of this year, is the market had a tantrum. It wasn't a taper tantrum because the Fed didn't tell us that they were changing policy yet. It wasn't a rate hike tantrum because the Fed obviously didn't tell us they were going to hike rates. It was a bond market that decided, you know what, inflation's an issue right now, and we're going to adjust. Now, granted, of course, yields have fallen because for a variety of reasons, but it was a sign that the bond market has no problem with sort of adjusting to where they think rates should be, irrespective of where the Fed wants them to be.
So, Peter, what do you think the Fed can handle in terms of higher inflation? Because in all fairness, before COVID, before all these new spending programs, inflation was still, for the most part, stuck under that 2% level that the Fed wanted. And the Fed was even saying, look, we're okay with inflation running hotter to average out some of those slower months and even years where inflation was under 2%. Now we're over 2%, and inflation's come back a little bit from some of those much higher readings at 5%+. How long do you think the Fed could withstand, say, 3 or 4% inflation?
Well, I think the question to answering that is how the bond market responds first, because the Fed tends to follow the market. And if the market starts to get really uncomfortable with persistent inflation and starts to adjust rates in the face of anything the Fed will do, the Fed will then follow suit. How they will follow suit, I'm not exactly sure, whether they would speed up the tapering or start talking about rate hikes. But I think they're going to actually take their cue from the market. They'll take their cue from inflation expectations and tips. They'll take their cue from the inflation questions in the confidence numbers, where real wages go, because that's the problem the Fed has, is we have a stagflationary type environment right now. And that is a central banker's worst nightmare. So I would call like policy right now is basically cross your finger type policy, that they're hoping and praying that inflation falls back down so they can sort of wrest control of a policy back into their own court, I guess you can say.
Well, Peter, one of the things you mentioned just a minute ago was that the bond market took it in its own hands to adjust rates the way they felt it should be, because the Fed is admittedly behind the curve. So one of the concerns a lot of analysts have is if this tapering moves forward, and we'll wait to see how it goes at Jackson Hole and at the September Fed meeting, but if they do start tapering and it's meaningful and they set up a timeline and they start going, if they go aggressively and they're not buying those bonds, right now they're spending $120 billion a month on bonds. If they dial it back to $90 billion and then $60 billion and then $30 billion, the question is who's going to buy those bonds? And if nobody is, rates will naturally, the 10-year and the 30-year will rise as a result of that, which would then potentially crimp some of these big moves we've seen higher in the markets. How do you think that plays into this factor of as they taper, it could actually cause a new taper tantrum down the road?
Well, interestingly, when they ended QE1 and QE2, and they tapered QE3, is yields actually fell. And when they initiated QE, yields actually rose, because the market interpreted it as, okay, QE on, let's steepen the curve, because that's reflationary of QE. But when QE stops, that's potentially contractionary, potentially could lead to a slowdown, so let's flatten the curve. So I'm not exactly sure how the long end will respond to the end of QE, because we still have U.S. banks that are potentially big buyers of treasuries. The U.S. government, while they're still selling an enormous amount of treasuries to finance the huge budget deficit of the U.S., that budget deficit should shrink this year compared to the last couple of years, or should say relative to, you know, the COVID time. So it's not as clear-cut as, okay, when the Fed is done, rates rise. When the Fed is doing this, rates fall, because we've seen counterintuitively reverse responses. I think the biggest influence on QE, well, no doubt it's monetizing the debt. So, yes, I mean, we do have to replace that. But even as they do taper QE, they're still going to be buying a lot of bonds for that time frame that they're going to be scaling back. And it's not as clear as where rates go when that happens. I think it's, and even it may not be clear when the Fed starts raising interest rates, because that may flatten the curve even more if people are worried about the growth implications of rate hikes.
What about globally too, Peter, when it comes to inflation data? What have you been noticing in terms of global inflation data and also central banks? We've had some of the smaller central banks already start to tighten and increase rates. Some of the larger central banks, so they do seem to be resisting that and using the Delta variant as a reason for that. How are you looking at the global picture here?
Well, it is interesting that many developing central banks who have a lot of experience with inflation have been raising interest rates. Brazil, Russia, Mexico, and others. Canada has been tapering QE. So I think that there has been, at least for some countries, Norway has hinted that they're going to be raising rates soon. South Korea said they're going to be raising rates soon. So there has been a response to the possibility of it. Now, wholesale inflation is a global phenomenon. Supply shortages is a global phenomenon. The cost of transportation and shipping skyrocketing is a global phenomenon. But from a consumer standpoint, different countries have had their own idiosyncratic ability to pass that on. Like, take Japan, for example. One of the things that's been keeping a lid on consumer price inflation in Japan, even though producer price increases have been pretty robust, is a 40% year-over-year decline in mobile phone fees. Well, that is a lot to do with government mandate and edict for those big declines. So it's also how they measure it. I mean, Europe measures the rent or housing component of inflation at a much smaller percentage than the U.S. And it's too low, and they're actually trying to readjust it. So they understate inflation if you would include housing prices, and housing prices in many parts of Europe have gone through the roof because of low interest rates. But I think overall the trend is higher when it comes to consumer price increases. And ironically, this is what central banks have rooted for, because they nonsensically root for higher inflation. And it'll be interesting to see how they respond to it once they get it.
Yeah, it's interesting that they were rooting for higher inflation for so long, and then they got there, and instead of taking a victory lap, they started talking it back down as transitory. But another component to the transportation is energy cost. And as energy costs, like we've seen what happened with oil and gas. You know, oil was negative last year at one point and very low. And then it's been in the 60s to 80s this year. So that's a huge component to inflation, because it affects how goods are shipped around the world, the input costs that companies have. And so that's a big pressure. But there's also the wage pressure that's growing. And so in addition to some of the hotter inflation metrics, we also have wages rising, not just in this country, but globally. And that kind of puts a cost push inflation scenario together, where you have rising prices mixed with rising wages. Do you think that's going to culminate into something where people have to address the inflation issue and admit that it may not be transitory?
I believe so. And to your point about wages, particularly on the leisure and hospitality side. Now we'll see how that plays out with Delta, even though I'm more confident that we'll be able to get in control of it. But there are labor shortages in many different parts of the market, and there's no question that wages are going up in certain sectors of the economy, maybe less so in others, but certainly in certain parts, and that then feeds into the whole inflation theme. Again, we're not going to run, inflation's not going to run the 7-8% annualized rate that we've seen so far this year. But even if it falls to 3-4, maybe even 5%, you know, that ends up being a serious problem. You know, unfortunately, most people in the markets were either a child in the 1970s, such as myself, or they weren't even alive in the 1970s. So they don't know anything of what sticky, persistent inflation looks like. They always assume that, hey, it goes up, it'll come right back down, and the Fed will do whatever they want to keep everyone happy. And I think we're potentially entering a situation where it's just not going to be that easy.
All right, Peter, let's switch over to some of the markets then. Let's start off with the U.S. equity markets because, look, even though we are seeing some extremely weak breadth, so just a few stocks, really a handful of the tech stocks and Tesla leading the U.S. markets higher and keeping them pretty much at all-time highs, we continue to see any short-term weakness bought, that whole buy-the-dip mentality, still very obvious for U.S. markets. Maybe it's just a sign of us being in summer and active traders not wanting to get too picky or active, but again, the broad averages staying at all-time highs. What do you think about the overall health of these U.S. markets?
Well, as you said, the breadth has been pretty crappy over the last couple of months, so you know, that's been a warning flag. But you know, for the broad indices, there's just an amazing resiliency and a desire to buy every single pullback. Now, if, and I emphasize if, the Fed follows through with tapering, and that begins in a couple months, then I think all that changes. I think the whole risk profile changes. But the market, you know, in a way, either doesn't believe that they're going to follow through, or if they do, who knows if they'll even make it through. So there's almost this like game of chicken right now between the stock market and even credit markets and the Fed tapering. I think that is quite a nonchalant attitude since, you know, the key reason why we're at these levels is because of QE and zero rates. But, you know, sometimes the market, a lot of times the market, at least over the last 10 plus years, has been very reactive rather than a discounting mechanism or proactive. So I think if Friday Powell said, you know what, yeah, Delta is a concern, but we're going to start tapering, where it lays the groundwork for wording of that kind in September, then you'll have a much different market on Friday than you have today. I know people are going to hear this weekend, but the point is that depending on what he says in Jackson, which he may not say anything, he may not want to commit ahead of the FOMC meeting a month from now, but if he does commit in one direction or another, my point is that the Monday rally could be different after he gives his speech.
Another point to consider is how much the foreign investment capital has flowed into the United States general markets because there's been weakness abroad. We can look to China and see how their regulatory pressures, particularly in their tech sector, has really hammered their markets down. And a lot of investors are fleeing some of those areas that have not been performing as well overseas and are using the U.S. markets as their safe haven, in a sense, or even flooding into the dollar. We saw some strength in the dollar over the last week. What do you make of that phenomenon, and could that be another tailwind for the U.S. markets?
I don't know. I'm always skeptical of calling flows as a factor to move markets, because for every foreign buyer of U.S. stock, there's somebody selling that stock to them. So for every dollar that goes in, it's a dollar going out. If you look at the U.S. Treasury market, foreigners have been reducing their exposure for years. They used to own half the U.S. Treasury market. Now they own about a third. And every time they buy a U.S. stock, they have a choice of whether they want to take the dollar currency risk or hedge it out. You know, from a valuation perspective, it was the last 10 years that the U.S. market performed so incredibly well against everybody else. And if anything, to me, there are more attractive opportunities outside the U.S. when you look out over the next 10 years. So, yeah, maybe foreigners do come here, but if they're deciding now for the first time to come here, I think it would be a bit too late.
Where are you seeing some of those opportunities outside of the U.S. then, Peter?
Notwithstanding what's gone on in China over the past couple months, beginning with the crackdown on Ant and Alibaba, I think that Asia, emerging markets in Asia, to me, and even some of the developed like Japan and Singapore, are going to be really attractive markets. They're valued cheaply, and I think that's where the growth is going to be economically when looking out over the next decade. I also find the UK market pretty attractive. There are a lot of cheap energy, financial commodity names there, among others, REITs too. That market's sort of been left for dead ever since Brexit, and you get a good dividend yield. Now, granted, these are value-type situations, and the reason why the U.S. has so outperformed everybody else is because of the, obviously, the well-known big-cap tech companies that outside of China, the rest of the world doesn't necessarily have. But thinking from a valuation perspective, there's some pretty attractive ones. Japan is very attractive, I think, with a lot of top-notch companies with some of the best balance sheets in the world. So I think just relying on what worked over the last couple of years or the last 10 years may not work as well when looking out over the next couple of years and even the next decade.
Well, just finally shifting over to one more market, and that's the commodity sector. We had a pretty good run in many of the commodities earlier in the year. We saw base metals, you know, copper, nickel, zinc, lead, all heading higher. Oil had the nice recovery we discussed earlier. The precious metals have been under pressure most of this time period. But over the last month or so, maybe 2 months, we saw the commodity sector weaken again, and it kind of went back down to support. How do you see the setup moving forward in the commodity sector?
Well, to me, the sell-off was all about the Delta variant causing concerns about growth. So that resulted in the pullback in oil and certainly copper. Lumber sort of was its own asset class and had its parabolic move higher. But even with the pullback, it's still well above where it was pre-COVID. I do think we're in a commodity bull market. I think we've had years of underinvestment. I think if you look at the energy sector, you know, the last thing an oil CEO is thinking about doing is investing a lot in new projects because they see that many people in the world want to put them out of business. So you're going to see years of underinvestment in oil and gas, still pretty good demand over the next 10 years. And at least in the next couple of years, I think you're going to see persistently higher prices. Copper, there's been a lack of investment in new mines for years. And I think it's pretty clear the demand drivers going forward for copper. I think agriculture, I think China is now a major, major player in the demand for grains and row crops like corn and soybeans. And while at least the U.S. farmer is incredibly productive and has for years continued to increase the yield on their farms, I think that the voracious demand, particularly out of China, will offset that. And ag prices will continue to go higher. And I think there's a trade there. And precious metals, which this year has been a very frustrating year, I do think that it's in the context of a strong year last year, and also will get its legs going again when people realize that inflation is not so temporary.
Peter, what do you think about the underperformance of especially the precious metals stocks and the miners generating good revenue numbers? I understand that the argument can be that, well, their input costs are going up and the underlying metals prices have been drifting, and the market, well, it's a forward-looking instrument here, and it's been telling us that metals prices, especially gold prices, were going lower. Again, though, your thoughts on just the general underperformance of these majors that have much healthier balance sheets now?
They do, and robust earnings and cash flow, and I think it's the sector that's been left for dead for years. I think that people, like I said earlier, believe that inflation is transitory and that any uptick is going to be short-lived. And not many people believe in gold. They're more obsessed with Bitcoin. And it's just a group that has just been neglected in the face of some really good fundamentals. Now, granted, the mining business is tough, and there's not that consistency of earnings that you see quarter over quarter that people like to see when they buy Google or even Coca-Cola. But that's just the way it is. But, you know, as you say, even with higher costs, margins are still really big and really fat for these miners. And I think at some point when gold and silver, which they will, I believe, takes their next leg higher, the miners will get a lot more attention again.
So, Peter, let's wrap it up with just a general summary then in terms of the key markets you're watching, key data points. Now that we are progressing closer to the end of summer, we can assume the trading is going to pick up and maybe some new trends be established. What do you think is going to be important to watch as we move through, let's just say, the rest of this year?
Well, bottom line is what's the Fed going to do with QE? And where does inflation go from here? Because they may want to sit on their hands with QE until they get a better comfort level with COVID. But if inflation is going to continue to run hot through year end, which I expect it to, and certainly into 2022, then that may force the Fed's hands. And the last thing the Fed wants to do is be forced to react to things rather than doing it on their own volition and timeline. So to me, it's all about inflation. Are we in stagflation? I think we are. Will it continue? I think it will. And what that means for Fed policy.
All right. So inflation and Fed, still the keys that we need to be watching for. I'm with you, Peter, but boy, oh boy, the Fed has started telling us that they are, well, thinking of tightening here, but or at least winding down the QE program. We'll see if that actually happens. Peter, it's always great chatting with you. Thank you for taking time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and I look forward to chatting with you again in a little while.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.